Hi there, and welcome to another episode of Talented Tales. This week, we welcome Aitan Hilton, director of Cubed Consultancy, onto the show. We actually recorded this show back on February the 14th, and for those of you who are old romantics will know that that's St. Valentine's Day. So we get a little window, I suppose, into our guest's romantic side, and he definitely put me to shame. What did we talk about on this episode of Talented Tales? Well, we spoke about the notion of choice via the medium of speccing sports cars, which was really, really interesting. We then spoke about Lego technique and the paradox of simplicity and complexity, all at the same time of taking us back to our youth, our childhood. And then we get into the real crux of where is the recruitment industry going, and the notion, are we on the cusp of an AI versus AI evolution, or is it a revolution through innovation? AI versus AI being artificial versus actual intelligence. Aitan brings some really, really interesting discussion points to this podcast. So check it out and hope you enjoy. Hi, Aitan, you okay?
Very well, thank you. Very well. Good morning.
Good. How are you today on this special day?
Yeah, I'm very good. Very good. Pleased to have been able to let the wife go off to work with a smile. So yeah, I think I'm in the good books.
So just for clarity, because that may come across as something slightly different on the podcast. We are recording this on Valentine's Day, aren't we, Aitan?
And we are indeed. Yes, that's correct.
We are. So just before we started there, we were just having a little chat around Valentine's presents, and Aitan's put me to shame. I'm sorry to say. So I think I've got to readdress my Valentine's Day gifting moving forward. But I did see this morning, Aitan, that apart from being a talented recruitment individual you are, that you've also dipped your toe into a little bit of poetry. I saw on LinkedIn this morning. Would you like to recite?
I'll see if I can remember it. I think it was something like roses are red, violets are blue, I'm immediately available to work with you.
Perfect. So there we go. So nice little pun for Aitan, and you'll learn a lot more about him actually over the next sort of 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and talented individual in the space, and he's got some spare capacity in his diary at the moment. So really worthwhile, anyone who is looking for a talented senior talent professional, then do get in touch with them. So that put a little smile to my face this morning, I have to admit.
You're welcome.
But on a more factual basis, with regards to Valentine, and I know there's lovers and I know there's haters out there, I do believe we have the ancient Romans to blame for Saint Valentine's Day, and I believe that it was a feast day in the middle of February in an effort to Christianize the pagan celebration of Lupercalia. So a nice little interesting fact for you there, courtesy of my friend Google.
Very good, very good.
Yes, so happy Valentine's Day to all those romantics. Right, let's crack on with podcast. So welcome to Talented Tales, Aitan. Really good to have you on. So I first met you probably about 18 months ago now, maybe a little bit longer, was it, Aitan?
I think so. That sounds about right. I think it was a think tank that we were both attending. So yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, about 18 months ago. And I think what stood out for me there, and I think this is where we kind of struck up, you know, the relationship that we've got, and we've kept in touch ever since. You know, I'm part of what you do, often refer to you and tag you on online, really kind of value
value what you do online and a lot of the snippets. But what stood out for me in that particular think tank was all too often when you're at events like that, and the Oasis HR one's a very good one, by the way, if you're looking at getting involved in something. You've got a really good WhatsApp group going, sat in behind that as well, really, really active. You just spoke plainly. You spoke in common sense. And having got to know you over the last 18 months, I know it's one of the tags of a lot of the work that you do. You keep things really simple, okay? And I think that is often lost in the industry. So it was kind of one of the reasons why I reached out to you following it. So yeah, we've kind of been in touch ever since, haven't we? So I thought it was about high time that, you know, we got you on Talented Tales, because Talented Tales is something, a podcast that actually we don't do that many of them. We don't try and do that many of them. It's not about that. But what it is about is real people doing real work in real businesses. Okay, so we're not trying to sugarcoat stuff. It's just the reality of all of that good stuff and good work that's going on that perhaps you don't always get to hear about. And you know, we feel really passionate about giving people the platform to talk about that and giving people the opportunity to access learning, because that's essentially what it's about. So look, without further ado, I'll stop rambling on and yeah, really over to you, Aitan. I mean, tell us, you know, who you are, what you do, why you do it, and where you do it, please.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, thanks very much for the opportunity, first of all, to share, you know, 30 or 40 minutes with you this morning. A pleasure, as I say, to do this, and also to have known you for the 18 months or so that you've introduced as well. So, yeah, in terms of who I am and what I do, I've been a recruitment professional now for a little over 14 years. The journey began, as it does with most of us in this profession, by accident. Kind of fell into it as an alternative income, and thought, you know, it will see me through for a year or two till I decide what I wanted to do. And then fast forward 14 years later, you know, still very much part of that industry. Spent the first, I think, 5 or 6 years agency side. So, you know, construction, engineering were typically the industry sectors that I worked within, accounts like TfL, Crossrail, Network Rail, and then some of your more mainstream sort of contractors in the construction world. That kind of led on to a key accounts focus. So quite large accounts with, you know, circa 200 or 300 contractors. In each client, you know, 10 to 15 million pounds turnover each. And my role was to run teams that, you know, maintained and serviced those clients, but also, you know, opportunities for organic growth to bring in a bit more margin and revenue. I then kind of realized that, you know, front end 360 recruitment wasn't necessarily for me, but, you know, that I did have strengths in other sort of areas of recruitment, typically with the clients. And so I moved into the transition world of RPO, outsourced yeah. solutions for a couple of years. And that was really kind of my bridge into the client side world, where I've been now for 7 and a bit years as a professional interim. The last couple of years of those with my own small consultancy, just offering a slightly more kind of fine-tuned strategic offering to clients in three main areas. So operating models and strategy. Supply chain and frameworks by way of PSLs, and then recruitment technology. So although there's a lot more to it than that, they're the three headlines of what clients are sort of coming to me in the last couple of years and asking to help them with. So what am I doing sort of at the moment? One of my clients that I was with full-time for 6 months, Yonder Group, in a nutshell, they are hyperscale data center solution specialists. That project kind of came to a conclusion full time, but they've retained me for a couple of days a month, a couple of days a week, just to kind of help support transition the projects into an internal team that will obviously run them longer term. So I find myself available online way too much, too many posts on LinkedIn, but, you know, they entertain me, and I think they entertain a few of the followers as well. And then a chance to go to the gym a bit more often as well. So That's where I'm up to at the moment.
And is the gym working out for you? Next time I see you, will you sort of have the shape of a Ronaldo, or
If I went to the gym for 300 years, I don't think I'd ever look like Ronaldo's body. The main problem I've always had with the gym is not the workouts themselves. It's the indisciplined eating in between the gym sessions. So, yeah, I have to accept the dad bod that I carry around with me every day. And approaching 40 next year, again, it gives me sort of a bit of an excuse to say that, you know, once the crisis kicks in, maybe the abs will kick in as well.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I'm a bit like you, I suppose. I'm more built for comfort than I am speed.
Absolutely, especially during the winter.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Good. Well, look. Yeah. Great intro, and I think as a background and a history, you know, and an experience where you've come from, really good. You know, good exposure on the agency side, as you said. And I think a really interesting point, and it doesn't happen, I don't think, that often in many people's careers, let's say, or working lives, is actually you've kind of taken control of what it is you want to do. You identified, you know, 360 wasn't 360 recruitment, perhaps was something that you'd want to move away from, perhaps weren't enjoying it that much, and then, okay, I want to go and try something new, okay, similar space, RPO, and that's what it's all about for me, which is trying new things, learning in an industry and developing your knowledge, which ultimately puts you doing what you do at the moment in the consultancy cubes. So yeah, really interested. Just quickly, I didn't want to interrupt you when you were doing your intro, but what were you doing before you, as you say, fell into recruitment? It always intrigues me because everyone says they fall into recruitment. I fell into sales. My parents wanted me, my dad in particular, wanted me to be an accountant. And when I discovered I couldn't add up, and I really hated working with numbers in that way, but I really liked talking to people, I kind of fell into sales. So what were you doing before, Aiton?
Yeah, so believe it or not, I am a graduate just. So I did scrape my way through university. And I think as well, you know, I went to uni because I felt it was the right thing to do. Didn't really know what, you know, I wanted to study, but, you know, always had an interest in sort of graphic design, advertising, marketing. So I did a degree in colouring in and just about graduated. And then, you know, I started to find myself doing a few logo designs, business cards, helping local restaurants with menus, you know, small things like that, that I kind of thought, hopefully this can turn into, you know, a bigger career. The mistake I perhaps made in hindsight is having done a gap year and a work placement in London with Saatchi & Saatchi Design House. What I should have actually done was just stayed, you know, as a runner at 19 years old and kind of, you know, spent 3 or 4 years working my way up the chain. As a graduate, you know, 4 years later, I was nowhere any further ahead than those people at 23 that had been, you know, running in London for 3 or 4 years. So the degree was almost irrelevant, but I tried to kind of leverage it. But, you know, at £10,000 or £12,000 a year income, of which a quarter of that would have to go on a train fare, it just wasn't happening. So, you know, someone said, would you be interested in selling some CAD software, which I thought was loosely linked to a design degree. So I was selling kitchen design software in the southeast of England, and, you know, doing some of the demos and pulling together some funky designs for kitchens. And then I saw an advert for Hilmer Glynn in Welwyn Garden City for a recruiter. I think there was an OTE of around about 90 to 100k a year, which obviously lured me in.
Yeah.
And you know,
that old chestnut.
Yeah, the rest is history. You know, you make a quick bit of commission, particularly on a contractor desk, and that was it. I was in. I was hooked. And as I say, yeah, the rest is history.
And you're here to stay.
For the time being, you know, one of the things that I've consciously done, and to your point a moment ago around, you know, choosing two or three elements of an industry that I want to focus on, over the last, you know, 14 or so years, I've had the pleasure and privilege of working with nearly 20 different organisations. And they're spread across 9 or 10 different sectors and industries, you know, from financial services, pharmaceutical, life sciences, construction. I've worked for the government, you know, and what that's helped, hopefully allowed me to do is demonstrate to people that I can apply my skills in any sector, purely because I've become a specialist in recruitment and talent acquisition, not necessarily a specialist in any given sector. And I think that's something that a lot of professionals in this industry struggle with, because, you know, their skills are extremely transferable, but clients or organizations only want someone with, you know, financial services, or only someone with pharmaceutical, whereas, you know, the clients I've had, thankfully, have been a bit more open-minded than that.
Well, it's the age-old question, isn't it, in this industry? And it does happen in other industries. You know, I'm not exclusively from a recruitment background as such. But especially in this industry, I find that, you know, there is still that mindset that, okay, I want a specialist financial recruiter, or I want a specialist law recruiter. And there's merit in that. I get that. I understand that. But again, I constantly hear people, and I think I'm more of this opinion as well, which is, if you've got a recruiter who is a good recruiter, full stop, agnostic by sector, then exactly like you say, those skills are transferable into other sectors, aren't they?
Absolutely.
And then, you know, what's more effective? Okay, someone who is a good recruiter, yeah, who can find good people, who can put good processes in place, who understands to engage people, as opposed to just being a specialist in that sector. And, you know, for me, it's about having that choice. And presenting that choice then to, you know, the potential clients that you work with, or the potential candidates that you know, you might be looking to hire on behalf of the company you're working for. And just on that point of choice, I think we share a mutual passion. I think your passion is a bit more real than mine, but that's in kind of sports cars and supercars and hypercars. I hasten to add, neither of us own a hypercar.
No, yet.
But we may be on one of those rungs of those ladders. And one of the things we're going to chat about really is that analogy of Porsche. And I know Porsche is something that is close to your heart. So talk to us a little bit about the fun and games of speccing a 911.
Sure. So just to caveat that point, so I didn't quite make it to 911 status yet. I ended up with a Cayman GTS, which is a sort of a baby 911. But I'm assured by purists that it is just as much of a driving experience as the 911. So I'm pleased and you know, very grateful that works and life have allowed me to get there. But that said, you know, I've had a love for Porsches since I was a kid, as I have done for, you know, supercars and fast cars, I think ever since I was about 4 or 5. But one of the things that struck me, you know,
What was the first car you had up on your wall poster?
I think it was a Ferrari F40.
Oh.
Yeah, I think that there was a fortnightly magazine called Fast Car that I used to get. And it used to have a sort of a centerfold spread, you know, innocently back then. and I think the F40 was, I think, one of the first ones that went up onto the screen, onto the wall, sorry. And at the time, there were annual exhibitions at Earls Court for supercars as well.
Yeah, went to that.
Yeah. Remember as a kid, you know, very much kind of going out there and seeing these in the flesh and you know, absolutely falling in love with them from a very young age. But yeah, so with the 911 sort of, I suppose, anecdote, I didn't realize at the time when I was, you know, looking to get my own car that there is actually 24 base models for a 911. And these Wow. range from about 78,000 all the way up to just over 205,000. But if you were to look at them visually, you would struggle to see a huge difference, bearing in mind the spectrum of specs and also the cost. But that's just 24 base models. Beyond that, you can then tailor them, you know, endlessly almost to your satisfaction. And what this made me realize is that Porsche has kind of, you know, still found a way of turning one of the most popular, you know, highly purchased, sports car or top-end sports car for their individual clients. So, you know, if you could afford maybe 80 to 90,000, there's something there very much for you. right the way through to the sort of more exclusive end of the market at, you know, 200,000 plus. And what they do is, you know, from the very beginning, your first trip into the showroom, right the way through to the day that you collect the vehicle, and even the aftercare, you know, for the rest of your first year, is just phenomenal. And it got me thinking. I wrote a piece that linked, you know, Porsche to executive search, and how when the two are done correctly, you know, it's ultimately choice that you're providing clients and candidates, and it's tailored to the individual, even though it may have a blueprint that's much more generic than we realize. So yeah, you know, I love the brand, love what they do, and it's very subtle how they do it. And it kind of, you know, gets me thinking about the subtleties that we can introduce into, you know, what we do every day with, you know, tens or hundreds of candidates, you know, a handful of clients, and keeping it sort of fresh for a long period of time.
And that's the real point here. So, for anyone listening, you know, as much as Ayton and I would love to indulge our passion for fast cars on here, and I had an F40 on the wall as well, by the way, but I also had its arch nemesis alongside it, the Lamborghini Countach, as well. But the real point here is that it is about choice, isn't it? And providing that tailored solution to your candidates. So let's delve a little bit deeper into that and talk a little bit more around, you know, things that can be done in order to do that, and you know, that actually how that works and how that happens.
Sure. Yeah. Just to kind of loop back in a point from earlier about, you know, what makes a good recruiter. You know, we all know nowadays that the sourcing element, or at least the identification part of, you know, finding who you want to find, at least on paper, is getting increasingly easier and easier. Now, that's not to take anything away from recruiters, but the reality of social media, automation, you know, LinkedIn, those kind of platforms, I think at least make, you know, that specialist recruiter a little less specialist, because ultimately, you know, filters and search functions are doing that for us. But presenting the client with the right choices, I think, still remains part of the art of what we do. And that's where definitely I think the skills for us as recruitment professionals to identify, well, what is the choice that the client wants versus what is the best option to put in front of the candidate. And, you know, without weaving in too many topics, you know, that's where I think diversity and inclusion, again, plays a huge part, because, you know, 20 years ago, candidate shortlists were almost carbon copies of each other with very little to choose between them, because, you know, the three best candidates or the five best candidates were almost carbon copies. The reality nowadays is that, you know, your shortlist of three to five candidates for the client to choose between can ultimately still be competent and capable, but actually they could be very different to choose between, whether it's the background that person comes from, whether it's, you know, an industry individual and a competitor that they're pinching from, or if it's someone that's completely left field that will push the boundaries of an organization that they say that they want to. And that's where I think choice nowadays is different to how it was 5, 10, 15 years ago.
And that's a good thing. That is absolutely a good thing, you know, to make organizations and workforces more diverse. You know, it, as you rightly say, Ayton, it drives innovation in companies. So I think it's absolutely the way the industry should be moving. And I think, you know, we hear it all the time, don't we? And you touched on it a moment ago there, around automation. You know, a lot of that, not all of it, but a lot of that is being augmented and driven by technology within the recruitment industry. I mean, what are your thoughts around that? You know, where you personally feel tech is taking the recruitment industry? Because everyone, really, if you're working in the industry, should have an opinion on this, because it's so prevalent at this moment in time. I'd be seriously worried if you were working in the industry and you didn't have a view on it.
No.
I mean, where do you stand?
So, to the point about, you know, how many industry sectors I've worked across, I think what that highlights is that there's really different levels of maturity, depending on industry sector and sort of organization type, around how ready they are for innovation. So the recruitment process fundamentally doesn't really change from one sector to the other. You know, there are the main sort of, you know, stages of pre-recruitment, attraction, assessment, yeah. Offer management, onboarding, and then retention. That doesn't really change. But the technology and innovation levels within each of those six strands is hugely different from organization to organization and sector to sector. One of the things that I sometimes get asked when I join a new business is, you know, what innovation or what technology do you think we have to have? You know, what's the latest thing that people are doing? You know, I've heard about AI, I've heard about bots, you know, video interviewing, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing I always say to them is, you know, let's first have a look at how you do things now, how you might be able to do them, and then how you want to do them. Because they might be 5 or 10 years behind the curve, and actually innovation for them might be, you know, a 10-year, you know, old process that actually brings them forward. You know, if I go into an organization that isn't ready for video interviewing or doesn't understand the demographics of who's most likely to use them, it would be a wasted innovation to implement. You know, it would be costly and it would be pointless. The same way that automation nowadays, in my opinion, is making some recruiters a bit lazy. And by that, you know, it's because they're relying on the automation to send the candidates the updates or the messages or the auto responses. And they feel that that is engagement. It isn't. It's just a message. That engagement still has to be driven by a person or a function that sits behind the technology. So I think the pace at which the technology is evolving is absolutely incredible. And, you know, every 6 to 12 months, there's all sorts of wonderful things that, you know, blow my mind in terms of how they're, you know, designed and pulled together. But actually, you know, we almost need to take a step back first and understand, well, how capable and competent is our function, whether that's HR, talent, marketing, whatever it might be, before we go and spend or implement, you know, great bits of technology and kit that fundamentally will be wasted. And one of the best examples of that I've seen over the years, and it's a very simple, you know, platform, you know, LinkedIn Recruiter. People were spending 50, 100, you know, £200,000 a year on LinkedIn Recruiter and then complaining that it wasn't doing what it said it could do. But what they didn't realize is that actually you need people feeding that system and the project folders and the job ads, etc., on a sort of daily or weekly basis. It's not an automated platform, you know, to just deliver the best talent in the world. It needs kind of, you know, almost needs programming as such. My view is that technology is a good thing. It's a very real thing. But first we need to understand, you know, are we ready to use it before we go ahead and buy it all?
Isn't it just as simple as you drive the technology and the technology doesn't drive you? Isn't it just as simple as that?
It should be like that, yes. And again, I don't know if it's something that we were going to come on to a bit later, but you know, something I find fascinating is the argument around artificial intelligence versus actual intelligence. You know, there's lots of movies that I'm sure we've all seen and lots of debate at the moment around, you know, will AI ultimately kill off you know, jobs or skills and stuff.
Scaremongering, yeah.
Yeah, you know, when I worked for GDS, Government Digital Service, you know, they did a paper around, you know, how many government civil servant jobs would be, you know, almost obsolete by 2030 because they've either been automated or, you know, replaced by some sort of technology. And the argument there was that if we know we've got 10 or 15 years to go before a particular role or job becomes, you know, obsolete, it's our responsibility as individuals and professionals to upskill ourselves up the value chain. Mm-hmm. So the same way that, you know, 50 years ago in Detroit Motoring, when the production line started to become automated, people in those factories realized that actually the dashboards or the electronic circuit boards still needed human intervention or programming to put into, you know, the dashboard or the center console. So yes, the panels might have been put together by robots now, but actually the humans in the factory were doing the electronic stuff. So they realized that their value in the chain was the electronic piece, not the panels. So we, I think, have to do the same thing. We have to identify where is our value today versus, you know, where will it be against an automated world in 5 or 10 years time. And it will always be the same answer for, you know, recruitment professionals. It's that it's that human interaction, because we buy with our senses. You know, the minute you ring a help desk and you hear an automated robot, you know, telling you to click 1, 2, or 3, you know, you're 10% disengaged. As soon as you go online and a little chatbot comes up, you know, your heart sinks a little bit that are they going to know the answer? Because instinctively we believe that humans are better than robots. So in recruitment, I think that's why we've always got to stay slightly ahead, you know, but it's our responsibility to demonstrate that value. Otherwise, ultimately, yes, it will be overtaken by a robot.
Yeah, there's, I totally agree with you on the value chain piece. And I think you put it really eloquently there, which is understand where you currently sit in the value chain, but also understand where you can add value in the future. And that's the responsibility of both the organisation and the employee. Mm-hmm. And I think the best organisations, the organisations that perform, the most efficiently, are those organisations that create that environment for the employee to do that. And a good example of that at the moment, to my mind, is Amazon in the UK. And we all know what's happening in fulfillment centres, you know, all over the world. It's not going to be humans, you know, who are pushing trolleys around thousands and thousands of square foot of racking and stacking, picking and packing products. It's, you know, it's robots that are going to be doing that. And in some cases, they're doing it now. And, you know, Amazon has a program to build, I think it's somewhere in the region of another 10 fulfillment centers in the UK alone. So there'll be somewhere in the region of sort of 20 to 25 fulfillment centers, and they'll be predominantly operated by robots. Yep. So what they've done is they put a program in place, part funded by the apprenticeship levy in Amazon, to upskill those that want it to become the robotics engineers, the electrical engineers of the future. And that's a combination of new entrants to work, so, you know, early talent coming into the business, but also existing talent in the business that wants it as well. So, it's there, it's prevalent, but I just don't think it's as simple as saying, well, it's taken my job. It's the organisations that actually plan for that. And put those strategies in place. So I totally agree with you. Around having that awareness in the value chain. And I suppose the other point around that is, you touched on it right at the top of talking about, where tech will take the industry and over the next 15 years. So somebody like yourself who, at any one point could have multiple plates spinning, in a number of different clients. How prevalent is that conversation when you go to see a client? Okay, so hypothetically speaking, painting the scenario, your phone rings. Hi, Ayton. Yeah, you've heard loads about you. We want you to come in. We want you to take a look at our function here. How prevalent is that chat? Is that conversation around technology in organisations? And is it met with trepidation, fear, or is it met with embrace? So yeah, we really want a piece of this. We want to get on board in it, but we want to do it the right way. How do you feel that's happening in the clients you've interacted with, whether you've worked for them or not, Ayton?
Yeah. So I think it's a bit of a mixed bag, and it does depend a little bit on who the client is in terms of what they do, either as a consumer or a product or proposition. It's usually met with, it's quite welcomed, that they're very open-minded to what technology can bring them. They appreciate that, it's a reality that they have to acknowledge, because if they don't, they could potentially fall behind, generally speaking, or against their competitors. Whilst it's acknowledged, it is sort of reasonably quickly sort of put to one side as well, because the burning platform often is you know, a scarcity of skills or a shortage of talent in their business that they feel, you know, they desperately need to sort of catch up on. So ultimately, you know, a bit of a sort of plug personally here, but, you know, my sort of strap line is proactive prevention rather than reactive resolution. So, you know, I try to target clients that, you know, often say to me in the first conversation, no, we're fine, I10, you know, we're okay for now, thanks. And my point to them is, brilliant, you know, this is absolutely the best time to engage me, you know, 1, 2, 3 days a week. Because if you engage me at the point of, you know, we're really busy or we're really behind, that becomes reactive resolution, which is, you know, something I can do, but it's what I would prefer not to. And I often say to people, you know, when your volumes of recruitment are low, is the best time to actually invest in your function, because those same, you know, resources, yeah, whether that's, you know, an internal talent team, recruiters, HR business partners, you know, they do vary, you know, greatly from one company to another. You know, there are probably 15 or 20, you know, recruitment and talent acquisition work streams that a good business will always be sort of tinkering with for continuous improvement, technology being one of them. So if you find yourself with a relatively low vacancy workload, that's absolutely the best time to explore, you know, technology and innovation and where it could take you, because it will inevitably take 3, 6, 9 months to acquire it, you know, implement it. And ultimately you have to iterate it a few times as well for it to, you know, be completely fit for purpose and optimized. Whereas a lot of companies, you know, think that having bought it and plugged it in
day one,
you know, it needs to, you know, it will do what it needs to do from the beginning. So, you know, there's definitely a transactional element to the functions that I go into. But I try to play on the more kind of tactical and strategic elements of those functions. And that's where, you know, personally, I think, you know, it's a bit of a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing when I am working because it makes it more interesting and exciting for me. But it is a bit of a curse in between assignments because I'm not your traditional head of recruitment, head of talent acquisition, you know, on paper that goes in and runs something operationally. You know, I try to look at it much more longer term. And the irony of that is, you know, I may only be with a client for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, but I'm actually trying to talk to them about things that they're going to need to do and develop over 3 to 5 years. So yeah, it makes for interesting conversations, and technology is becoming more sort of, you know, pertinent in those conversations because it is everywhere. You know, there are very, very few activities in the life cycle of recruitment that are what I would describe as analog anymore. You know, technology is, you know, you've got auto signature contracts, you've got automated responses, you've got online booking forms for calendars that the candidate could, you know, there's a bit of technology almost at any and every stage, but a human being is ultimately accountable and responsible for the end-to-end life cycle. So yeah, clients are starting to sort of realize that more and more, definitely.
So what one single piece of advice, if we can, to top and tail this point, but what's one single piece of advice would you give to any HRD or resourcing director or recruitment director out there when it comes to, you know, the technology piece? What would you say is the most important thing for them to do? What's item one on the agenda? And look, there's more than one item on the agenda for sure.
Yeah. So I guess my advice would be just take a moment to understand the technology that is available versus the technology that you need. Obviously, you know, it's those companies' jobs as sales departments to, you know, woo you into buying their product. But whether it's the cheaper version or whether it's the more expensive version, just take a moment to sort of understand fully what it is that you're investing in and what it will take to optimize that product. And it won't always be the cheapest or the most expensive that's the best one to go for.
Absolutely. So understand what you really need and keep your eyes wide open. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So look, I think that's really good and simple advice. It's often, I think, a market, you know, by design sometimes as well. I feel, that's a skeptic in me, that tries to overcomplicate things. You know, it will import a level of complexity into a process so that it can reverse engineer a whole bunch of a whole bunch of time, if you like, and implementation into landing a piece of technology. And that kind of leads us nicely into our final point. And I know it's something that you talk about a lot, and I see it next to your brand a lot in the work that you do. And I agree with it. And I think you should absolutely 100% keep banging the drum, which is, and I hope I get this right, simplicity is the most important form of complexity.
So the strap line that I use is simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. But yeah, in the context of things, it aligns to what you just said. Yeah.
Yeah. So, absolutely. Apologies. Misquoting you there.
He was Leonardo da Vinci to begin with. So hopefully for him as well.
Bringing a bit of fun into today. Again, I know that you have a bit of time on your hands from time to time. And I think Santa was kind to you over the Christmas period, and another passion of yours, sort of anchoring those two points, is you've kind of gone back a few years, haven't you, and got yourself into a bit of Lego technique, I believe.
That's right, yes. So it was an opportunity to turn the clock back about 30 odd years. I was lucky enough, as you say, to get a nice Porsche model, Lego Technic Porsche model, around about 3,000 pieces altogether, very much enjoyed putting that together recently, over the course of sort of a day and a half or so. But the point being that, you know, when I was 7 or 8 years old and I made my first one, all these years later, the fundamentals of what Lego Technic do haven't really changed. You know, the pieces are the same. The processes are roughly the same. The complexity of some of the models, naturally has evolved and become a bit more detailed. But you know, what Lego have done, and they've done this, you know, over 60 or so years with, you know, their original concept is stayed true to it. But they've just managed to adapt to whatever's being done, in the contemporary world. And I sort of, you know, I refer to it as the paradox of simplicity and complexity at the same time, where, you know, 3,000 pieces, if you get one or two of them wrong, you know, the whole thing is not going to work properly, whether it's the moving parts of the engine or the steering column, whatever it might be. But actually, it looks very simple to do, but you've got like a 400-page instruction booklet. So, you know, I think about that in my own work, and I did a graphic a few years ago when I was first talking about Lego Technics, the Bugatti Chiron model that they've brought out, and used that as an underlay, as an image, with then the list of all of the elements of recruitment, of which there's, you know, probably nearly 100 elements that I sort of felt existed. And if you get, you know, two or three of those wrong, or you disregard them, you know, ultimately the whole process isn't going to quite work as it should, even though it looks very simple. So yeah, I like to sort of see analogies in, you know, the fun elements of what I do with my spare time, but always find a way of, as you say, weaving them into the realities of the work that I do, and trying to sort of, you know, come up with anecdotes or analogies for clients of, you know, that they may relate to or understand a bit more than just the sort of recruitment jargon that I spiel out every day.
No, and I think it's great. I love it, because I think, like you say, it's relatable. But most importantly, what's next on the list, Lego Technic?
Yeah, so it will be the Bugatti Chiron.
Will be, okay.
It will be, yeah. So if I find myself still, you know, looking for work in a couple of weeks, I think I'll commit to getting one of those and putting a week aside to do that. But yeah, I think you've only got to look at my son's bedroom. He's a bit of a Lego nut as well. And there's a range called Speed Champions. So when we went to Goodwood last year, he picked out all of his favourite cars from the day. And we've got all of the Lego replicas dotted around his bedroom wall on shelving. So, I don't want to be a pushy parent. It's his own choice.
He's a chip off the old block then, hey?
It appears to be so. So, I've just got to work on him for a few years not to fall into recruitment like his dad.
I don't think it's done his dad any harm, to be fair. Good. Okay, well, great. Iton, look, really enjoyed that today. I think I think you squarely hit, you know, what we're trying to do here, which is real people doing real things in real businesses. You keep things simple. You've got a wealth of experience that you bring to the table as well. I think the points you make are always, whether that be when we bump into one another at various events or when we catch up, when I'm in town or what I see you posting online, they're always well thought and they're always well researched as well, which is what I like about you. In an age of oversupply of content, there's always value in what you bring, I feel.
Thank you.
So thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it. And another plug for you, because I really think you're a good addition for any businesses. If anyone's wanting to connect with Iton or wanting to just really pick his brains and maybe grab him for a coffee, or if anyone's got any impending projects that they'd like to bring him in, then check him out online. I'll be putting up a link to obviously to your LinkedIn profile. Mm-hmm. When we push the podcast out, probably next week. Okay. But for sure, reach out to him, and if nothing else, if it's just to have a chat, and maybe you're a budding sports car fanatic like myself, or maybe you're a Lego technique nut like Iton, then reach out and have that chat, but well worth a conversation. So Iton, thanks a lot for your time today.
My pleasure, absolute pleasure. It's been great fun. I've not done one of these before. It's been really good. And again, thanks for sort of, inviting me in to do this. And hopefully, we get to do it again in the future at some point.
Absolutely. Enjoy the rest of your Valentine's Day and speak to you soon.
Yep, see you later. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Talented Tales. Loads more content over on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So dive straight in and let us know what you think. Until next time, see ya.